2. The Elflands did not have a king. A race born in service to the ancients, they shunned authority to the extent that even using the imperative in a conversation was considered unspeakably offensive. The notion of bowing to a ruler, be it a king or an emperor or an archvoyant, was anathema to them, and so their reclusive nation was driven by laws of courtesy and respect, answering to no one save their own collective culture. This system of government worked for the elves most of the time. For the rest, they had Mr. Dragon. Ribbon Darius, a sandy-haired former farm boy who was known more often as simply Derry, and much more rarely as the Champion of Dawn, heralded hero of prophecy, who had defeated the Champion of Dusk to save the world, kicked hard off the wall and sliced through the cool water on his final lap in Mr. Dragon's pool. It was confusing being with someone who was a dragon, as well as a very tall, very strong, very handsome man, as well as sort of the ruler of a small country. On the farm where Derry had grown up, people who ruled countries were great figures of myth and legend, and men who preferred the company of other men was something you told jokes about. After fulfilling his prophecy and saving the world, Derry had tried to figure out who he was. He tried to spend time with Ululenia, and he tried to join the Knights of Gedisar and hunt things that used magic to hurt people, but neither had felt right, and as someone who was made to fulfill a great purpose, Derry had learned to trust his heart. Mr. Dragon projected an authority that filled the room. He was a figure out of myth and legend, but none of that mattered. What mattered was that he and Derry liked each other, and the elves didn't care whose company you preferred. It was a long way from the farm, but Mr. Dragon's smile made Derry's stomach flip-flop. People in the Elflands didn't order each other around, and after fulfilling a prophecy, that felt good to Derry. He pulled strongly, the water roaring in his ears, and slapped the wall. Then he stood up, the tiny little stones that made up the mosaic on the bottom of the pool pinching his toes, like they always did, and took in great, gasping lungfuls of air.
"You've cut almost a minute off since the last time I saw you,"
came a voice from by the steam room, and Derry looked over to see Irathela Thlealan, the elf who oversaw Mr. Dragon's affairs outside the Elflands. He was taller even than Mr. Dragon, his skin pale green and the crystals upon his cheeks pale blue. His eyes were golden, like a cat's, and seemed most often locked in a perpetual state of disdain, also like a cat's. "Mr. Irathela Thlealan," Derry said politely. He didn't think the elf liked him, but because Derry was Mr. Dragon's boyfriend, the elf had never said so outright.
"Are you sure?"
"I am sure of very few things in this world."
Irathela Thlealan tossed Derry a towel.
"Precise measurements of time, however, are one of them. I heard the splash and crash as you began your swim and counted the laps based on when you slapped each wall. Same number of laps, 48 seconds shorter time."
"I've been practicing," Derry said proudly, holding the towel aloft as he climbed from the pool. He dried off his hair and face, then toweled his arms and legs.
"How was your trip?"
"Productive, I hope."
Irathela Thlealan watched the waves lap the sides of Mr. Dragon's pool.
"He'd like to speak with both of us."
"Oh, sorry to keep you waiting."
Derry toweled faster until his swim trunks stopped dripping.
"You're keeping him, not me," said Irathela Thlealan, and shook his head. "He asked that I wait until you are finished."
He smiled and added,
"I suppose it's in his best interests that you remain in good shape."
Derry blushed and finished drying himself off, then pulled on a loose, brightly coloured shirt and wrapped the towel around his waist over his trunks. He followed Irathela Thlealan through the great marble columns that surrounded the pool, past the fountain and small hedge maze, and into Mr. Dragon's home proper. Derry almost didn't get lost anymore. He'd learned to tell the different paintings of old people on the walls apart and find his way through the different wings of the palace. The other elven servants were always happy to give him directions as well, as were the fairy creatures who worked at the palace. Derry sometimes felt a little odd being the only human there, but after learning that the crystals most humans used hurt the elves' heads, he understood why they kept most other people out of their country. Irathela Thlealan led Derry to Mr. Dragon's study, a great room filled with stacks of books and lit by bright, shining glass spheres that hung from the ceiling. Mr. Dragon's home was built in a kind of circle shape, with a great garden in the middle, and almost every room let in light from the outside world. This study alone had no windows, and while Derry could find the room without trouble, and had been there countless times, he was still not entirely certain what part of the palace the room was even in. In the picture of the palace that lived in Derry's head, the study never seemed to fit. When he had asked Mr. Dragon about it, the great man had laughed and explained that a few tricks of walls and hallways could make a room seem to disappear, and that the study was a room where the things that needed to disappear could stay safe. Mr. Dragon was in his human shape, as he most often was inside, a tall, broad-shouldered man with a massive red beard. He always left his shirt open when at home, which let Derry clearly see the shimmering rainbow glow that shone from Mr. Dragon's heart, along with all of Mr. Dragon's chest and the muscles of his stomach, and all the other parts of his torso that made Derry blush again just by looking.
Derry!
The great man stood and pulled Derry into an enormous hug.
I'm sorry to bother you.
Derry leaned into the big man's body, which was always a little warmer than everyone else's.
How can I help? I have finished the book,
Mr. Dragon said, and the weight in his voice made Derry push away. Mr. Dragon's face was drawn and pale.
It was not easy, but I know what we need to know.
It's about time, Irithelof Leolon said from the doorway. As difficult as it was to keep the love song of Eilin Finial out of the hands of your friend, Captain Issafasira de Lochinville.
Captain Locke is a good lady, Derry said, as he always did.
For a human, Irithelof Leolon agreed.
This was another reason that Derry didn't think the elf liked him.
Please,
Mr. Dragon said, and they both stopped. His voice hit with the strength of a hammer, but even still, the tone was pained.
Please, both of you, this is not the time.
What did you find? Irithelof Leolon asked.
It's bad, isn't it? Derry added. Does it say when the ancients are going to return?
Mr. Dragon smiled.
After a fashion.
Irithelof Leolon went very still.
Shall I get the horn?
Not just yet, my friend.
Mr. Dragon looked at Derry.
Derry, I have something difficult to ask of you. Anything.
Derry stepped forward and took Mr. Dragon's hands.
You know that I'm not that great at reading, and I don't know much about magic, but if I can help, whatever it is. Thank you.
Mr. Dragon smiled again, the sad smile of a man who had lived for hundreds of years.
How quickly can you pack?
Handel Westyke had just finished climbing out of the chasm left by the destruction of the Forge of the Ancients and was leaning against the least crumpled wall of the tower itself, trying to get his breath back and clean the grime off his hands, when the airship landed.
Good afternoon, he called over.
As a noble from a family with money, political power, and land titles far from anywhere interesting, Westyke had a private airship, of course. He used it on his days off to take long flights around the countryside, learning about wind demons from the pilot the family kept on staff. This airship looked different from the one sitting under the shelter of the Westyke family's least popular gazebo. Instead of looking like a sea vessel with, for want of a better term, a giant balloon filled with demons holding it aloft, this airship was topped by a long metal tube, and its body was dark and narrow, with runners like a sled's on the bottom. It had no sail wings for steering. Its clean lines were broken only by bumpy extrusions that Westyke realized after a moment were flame cannons, several on each side. The airship was a shark in a world of whales and goldfish. Westyke's first thought was that he very much wanted that airship. His second thought was that it was unlikely anyone who had an airship like that had just been wandering through the neighborhood and stopped by to help. A gangplank extended, and a single figure, a heavy-set man whose face Westyke found vaguely familiar, walked down to the ground. He was unarmored but carried a pair of extremely impressive weapons, a great silver-handled war axe with a double-bladed golden head, and a silver-handled warhammer whose head was inlaid with glittering runes. The man was followed by a half dozen more figures, all of them wearing long dark coats and walking with the bearing of men from good families. Westyke felt an instant kinship with them. Had his family not been responsible for the forge, he might have been among them.
"You are the protector of the forge?" the apparent leader asked. "Yes, Lord Handel Westyke. I am so glad you showed up," Westyke said. "This entire situation is a wreck." "Explain what happened," the man said.
Something about his voice was off, though Westyke couldn't quite put a finger on it. What he could put a finger on was the tone of the conversation.
"This was a failure of information for which I hold my contacts in the network directly responsible," Westyke said. "I performed an excellent operation to entrap the remainder of the team that once worked for Captain Isavasira de Lockinville, an operation that proceeded flawlessly until the arrival of Locke herself ruined everything I had worked for."
"Locke,"
said the man, and this time his voice was a dry, croaking breath.
"That's impossible. Locke is dead," he added,
in a much more normal voice. And then, for some reason, he added,
"Concubni alte osophoris." "Locke being dead is what all my reports read," Westyke added. "And had I known she was alive, I would certainly have adjusted my own plans accordingly. Whoever is responsible for passing information to the forge has a lot of explaining to do." "Locke's continued survival is a surprise," the man said in his normal voice.
Westyke realized what was bothering him about it. The man's lips were moving when he spoke, but not entirely correctly. It was like watching an illusion whose voice wasn't synced with the image, or watching a slightly clumsy version of those puppet shows that told news to the peasants.
"Well, then, I am pleased to pass on the information," Westyke said. "And if resources are strained, I'd be happy to coordinate the search for her and her people, given that my own position has been compromised."
"No."
The man turned back to the airship and whistled once. Three more figures came down the gangplank, each of them in turn more unlikely than the last. The first was a cloaked figure, much like the others, walking with his arms folded together, such that no hint of flesh was visible. Unlike them, he was only the size of a dwarf, though heavily muscled, given the thickness of his robed arms. He walked with a sort of jittery, bouncing gait, as though hopping from leg to leg. The second ducked, as though she feared hitting her head on the underside of the airship. She was an ogre, judging by her size and her tusks, though she was clothed like a normal person. But something about her was wrong. At first, Westyke thought that her face was oddly bright, leathery and gnarled as it was. But then he realized it was because the sun was at her back and her face was unshadowed. In fact, she cast no shadow at all. The third sprang from the airship down to the ground, landing in a crouch with skeletal arms spread wide, her ragged peasant dress billowing around her. Her hair was wild and her face bony and feral, and as she walked forward, she left footprints of dead grass behind.
"We hunt?" the ogre asked, speaking as carefully as seemed possible for someone with massive tusks jutting from her lower jaw.
"Locke is alive,"
the heavy-set man said, and Westyke noticed that the ogre and the, whatever the woman in the dress was, were both looking not at the man himself, but at the axe he held.
"She has destroyed the forge."
"That may be all she planned, or she may have some additional goal.
Regardless, she is likely still nearby."
"Maybe city," said the hooded figure. "If city fight, many dead."
He spoke with a peculiar whistling tone under his words.
"Concubni alte osophoris."
The leader. No. Westyke saw that the man's lips hadn't even moved this time. It was the weapons he held. They were speaking.
"Unfortunate, but necessary."
The words, Westyke thought, came from the axe.
"Any blow you strike while hunting down Locke and her companions is in defense of the ancients and the coming light of their return. You are not murderers."
"Thank you," said the bony-faced woman,
and without another word, she and the others were off.
"The forge of the ancients has operated in secret for centuries," said the axe to Westyke in a sudden change of topic. "How must it feel to be the one upon whose watch it fell?" "I won't lie," Westyke said, without missing a beat. I'm greatly disappointed that failure on the part of our intelligence network led to this attack that cost us the forge, and I feel betrayed by those who claim to await the return of the ancients as eagerly as I do.
Do you?
The axe asked dryly.
So you are not attempting to entrap Locke's companions, using the forge of the ancients as bait, in some ill-considered attempt to improve your own standing?
I ask only to be remembered by the ancients as loyal when they return, Westyke said. And while I would willingly lay down my own life for such a cause, killing me in a fit of pique because our people failed to give me the information I needed would cost the ancients a valuable tool in their coming return.
He looked directly at the axe and added,
And as I understand it, the ancients do not discard useful tools casually.
There was a thoughtful silence.
Fool,
said the heavy-set man weakly, and then went completely silent, staring at Westyke through hollow eyes.
A man of your talents need never fear being considered unnecessary, the axe finally said,
and while its axe head had no face, it still managed to convey the impression of a smile. The heavy-set man shifted his grip, holding the axe just below the head, and offered it to Westyke, hilt first. It was the moment Westyke had waited for his entire life. The destruction of the forge had seemed a huge loss, but if it led him to working with more powerful people on more important projects, he would walk away from it with a smile upon his face. He reached out for the axe.
Wait!
The voice came from the edge of the chasm, and Westyke spun. No one else had been left when the forge had fallen. The hunters had all been crushed by the rocks. All save Commander Mirok, it seemed. It pulled itself over the edge of the chasm, its armor scuffed and smoking. Westyke remembered that Locke had thrown it into the assembly chamber, which usually generated a great deal of heat as it fused crystals together.
Operative Westyke was exemplary in the performance of his duties, it said, rising to its feet. But only average in his physical capability. His intelligence would be wasted were he reduced to a thrall, controlled by a sentient weapon.
Westyke very slowly lowered his hand.
I, meanwhile, lost my weapon in the destruction of the forge, nor do I have the means to gain another,
Mirok continued.
I am useless as a hunter, but still stand strong as a tool of the ancients.
Well, then, said the axe, far be it from me to ignore the advice of a veteran hunter. I am Arika Yorichi, the bringer of order, one of the few living souls of the ancients bound to a weapon to await the return of my brothers. And I need someone to hold me while I bring them back.
The heavy-set man tossed the axe to Commander Mirok, who caught it, spun it, and nodded thoughtfully.
Excellent,
the axe added, rolling out Mirok's shoulders and tilting his head back and forth.
This will do for now.
Westyke nodded and smiled, like a man who hadn't nearly been reduced to apparent thraldom a moment ago.
Now that that's settled, then, how can I best help you deal with Captain Locke and the others?
Locke is mine, said Arika Yorichi,
the bringer of order.
As for you, Kill's power could use a hand with a project of his own. You may find it interesting.
The axe chuckled.
If indeed you do wish to see the ancients return.